Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma, presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Last week on Thursday Live, we broadcast the third talk in the current series. Today, we present the fourth Q&A, that's question and answer program, in that series of discussions amongst a studio panel, which would discuss topics and questions arising out of Professor's earlier talks in this new series. And the panelists today are Radio Sai's Bishop Prishti and Sri Harishankar Bhatt from the Sri Sathya Sai Central Trust. So over to the panel to take this forward.
Yeah, thank you, Sunil.
And yes, who am I?
Yeah, as Professor Venkatraman, as always, will be answering the questions put up by the panelists. And so over to the panel to take this further.
It's very unfair. You are taking revenge. What did I do to you? Go ahead.
So, dear listeners, as you heard the announcement, and if you are someone who is following this series, you would know that we already had three sessions of Q&A. This is based on Professor Venkatraman's series of talks on the radio, which are reflections of what is written in the book, The Difficulty of Being Good, by the author Gurucharan Das. Professor read this book and then that set him thinking and trying to fathom what this author is trying to say, because he's talking about the subtle art of dharma. And there are a lot of questions that came up in Sir's mind, and he then tried to put both of these together. One is the views expressed by Gurucharan Das and what he had read in the Bhagavad Gita, and which had got a lot more clarity after listening to Bhagavan's discourses and working on his discourses for years. And if you have heard the talk, and if you have heard the Q&A sessions in this Thursday Live program in the last 4 or 5 weeks or more, you would have got a feel of where we are going and how we are trying to understand how to live this principle of dharma in real life. And this definitely is not something so simple. It's very subtle, and it's in some ways complicated, and that is the reason why we have a professor to have a Q&A session, because one thing is to read Gurucharan Das and then read professor's talk, the text of the talk, or listen to him. But then there are a lot of questions that come up because the topic is such, and that is the reason why we requested professor that, you know, we should spend some time in a Q&A session after every time he gave a talk, after every chapter, so that there's more clarity in our understanding of these concepts. The first chapter of Gurucharan Das's book was, rather, the first talk professor gave was on the prelude, which Gurucharan Das had written before he started all the chapters. And we had three Q&A sessions after the prelude. And then now professor has given two talks based on the first chapter. The title of the first chapter is Duryodhana's Envy. So Gurucharan Das very beautifully has dealt with various aspects of envy, competitive envy, envy, positive envy, specific envy, general envy, inequality. He has brought in a lot of concepts. And if you have heard Professor Venkatraman's talks in the last two Thursdays, you would have heard how he has tried to make sense of what he has said in the light of Bhagavan's teachings. And so that's where we stand. So today we'll move on. And before we proceed further and allow Sir to give us more insights, we thought we should just get more clarity on what he has shared in his talks. And the last Q&A session, we had Aman Javeri from the university. And today we have Harishankar. Aman will join us again later in the future program. So today we have Harishankar from the Sri Sathya Sai Central Trust. So Hari, you have had the chance to listen to professor's talks as well as read the book.
Yes.
So is there anything that you would like to get more clarity on?
I have not been able to read the book completely, but up to the point where you have written about. So one of the things, sir, like if you can, for the setting a context for today's session, as well as for the benefit of listeners, if you can delineate if there's any point of departure, like where you have on the take on dharma as opposed to what Mr. Gurucharan Das delineates in his book, sir. Is there any point of departure the way you look at dharma, or as what he calls the difficulty of dharma? So do you perceive that there is actually a difficulty in practicing dharma?
See, it all depends. It's not a cakewalk to go up to the Mount Everest.
Right.
For many years it was not possible. Afterwards, 1,000 people have done. Because they put the effort. Perhaps before all that I should say, I hope I don't confuse, since you're all saying I'm clarifying. My worry is whether I'm confusing. But coming back to your question, Gurcharan Das was quite upset by many of the shady things that began to happen after economic reforms. He was always an India watcher, and he believed India is capable of progress, leaping forward, and he was delighted to see that happening after the year 1990. He in fact wrote a book, India Unbound, having high expectations. And then he saw one big company collapse. It was doing extraordinarily well, its shares were soaring and all that, and yet it collapsed. And ultimately, it collapsed for a very stupid reason, so to say. The chairman of the company, CEO, who had probably held a very large number of shares, was bitten by some bug to show off. And a lot of money was spent on that. He had 5,000 designer suits and stuff like that. I think it must be a world record.
350
shoes and... 350 shoes, 350 watches, with 400 bells. I mean, I don't know what. I mean, that was only a small part. It caused a great crash. Company shares fell. Lots of people, 50,000 people lost jobs, it seems, in various places. And he said, what makes these people go crazy? Man was all right. He showed enterprise, built a big company. What makes them?
And there's nothing lacking in his life, so to
say. Nothing. Some switch flipped. And in the case of Wall Street, it was deliberate cheating. They got onto a slippery slope. First, they made the loss flexible. But that was not enough. They began downright cheating. And one fine day, it collapsed. What makes them do this? How should they behave? Where do I get the rules? So by chance he happened to be looking at Mahabharata, and then he said, let me try to see whether I can get the basic rules of human behavior. Many years ago, Socrates asked the question, how should we behave? I didn't know this till I read about it a few days ago. And that is Amartya Sen's book. In fact, that is a question we should be asking all the time, because the external conditions change.
Yes.
So how should I behave must become how should I behave in the present circumstances. So that is what he is trying to find out. So he goes back to Mahabharata and then says, how should I behave? How do I get the answer? Let me see what the story tells, what the epic tells. And he sees the epic through the eyes of various characters. It starts with Duryodhana, then goes to Draupadi, then he goes to Yudhishthira. So on, he goes through character. Only Yudhishthira gets two chances. All the others get only one chance. And then finally he comes up with something which he feels is suitable for today's society. It must be God-free, his dharma, must be decent, ethical, must not be require a god. And he didn't say it, but in my view, it has to be market friendly. So that is the kind of thing he has derived. Now, in science and mathematics, we start with the basis and then make deductions thereof. We take plane geometry, Euclidean geometry, there is an axiom we start with. Parallel lines meet at infinity. There is no proof, you just accept it. Once you accept that, the whole of Euclidean geometry comes. But Euclidean geometry has a limitation. And that limitation was explicitly discovered by Carl Gauss, famous mathematician. He was also employed by the King of Prussia. And one day King of Prussia told Gauss, "Hey Gauss, how much land do I have? Find out the area of my land." "Now you can calculate the area of any figure drawn on a plain sheet of paper. There are rules for it. You can get make approximation and get almost what you call 99.9% accuracy. Depending on how patient you are, you can increase the accuracy." Gauss found that if you drew a triangle on a sphere, because the earth is a sphere, you don't have any rules for it. So he had to invent spherical geometry. And it turns out, for example, in spherical geometry, some of the angles of a triangle is more than 180 degrees.
Yes.
This was new to him. So the rules are derived from a basis. All the Indian acts of parliament are supposed to have been consistent with the Indian constitution. So the constitution is the basis, this is a derivative. And if you don't have a derivative, the rule becomes a bit arbitrary.
Don't have a basis like a constitution.
Huh?
If you don't have a basis like the constitution.
On the other hand, you can all make ad hoc rules. Soccer, as the Americans say, football, as the English say. They decided these are the rules. Fine. You must play according to the rules. If not, it's a foul, the referee will blow a whistle. But the rules keep changing. The basics remain the same. The rules keep changing. So you have to adapt to that. So here, there is a slight difference. There is no sharp difference between the rule and the rule giver. You adopt and keep changing. The same happens with constitution. On the other hand, if the parliament passes an act which is inconsistent with the constitution, the Supreme Court will say this act is null and void. So they have to do one of two things. Modify the constitution so that it goes through, or pass the act with amendments that will make the act consistent with the Supreme expectations of interpretations of the Constitution. Those are things. In short, you need a basis. Now, in today's world, people say, I decide my personal morals in a certain context. So if everybody has the goalpost of his or her choice, then there is bound to be chaos. What I say is right, what you say is right. That is not what you call, that won't lead to a stable society. That's people must agree on these things.
A social contract. So
exactly. But what happens with respect to humans is, our life existed long before there was a thing called society.
Absolutely.
And a thing called social contract. Social contract came from Rousseau in the 18th century or so. But the concept evolved earlier. Much earlier. And the concept evolved not by invention, innovation or necessity.
Right.
Because there was something intrinsic in human beings. When human beings killed, they began to see that this was something harmful. And you don't kill unless there is some reason for it. You are attacked and all that. They had the power of reasoning. So where did that reasoning come from? Is there a source for it? There's been a question, and it has gone through a long evolution, came from God and all that. But later on, when people found that most of the things could be phenomena of nature could be explained, so why do we need God? We will agree that these are rules of being civilized, and we will start go on that basis. If I want to change it, I'll change it because it's convenient to me and all that. So you have started having flexible rules. And sometimes they are a bit what you call like humbug. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of war in today's world,
yes,
is unacceptable. But then people said, okay, we will fight war, Dharma Yuddha, they had Geneva Convention, all that. All that is nonsense. When you go and bomb ruthlessly whole night, the main idea being to kill the people and disrupt civic morale, it is not meeting your own norms of war. You say that is collateral damage.
Collateral damage.
Later, that is the latest. The whole idea of, I know during war, there was a Dresden firebombing. Throughout the night, 10,000 planes dropped bombs, whole city burned because of weather conditions. Tokyo, all houses used to be built of bamboo. 10, 15,000 people died in one night. There are questions. We call them moral questions. So where is this morality coming from? Should it not have a basis? And I argued, it doesn't come out of thin air. It comes out of the divinity that is all-pervasive, which is also in you. And therefore, the frame of reference, though it might seem to come from you, really comes from there. And as Lord said, Bijam Mam Sarva Bhutanam. So it is from me. And Gandhi put it nicely, the law and the lawgiver are one. He doesn't make a difference between dharma as the law and dharma as God. The law and lawgiver are one. So I want, that was stated by Gandhiji in 1931 in a speech which he recorded while in England. So my study of that book is from that perspective. You are trying to construct a framework. It has no basis. On that basis, you make all the statements. If I look at all your facts from here, many of the things you say, I don't agree with. I cannot agree with, and for the following reason, not merely because it violates my perspective, but the harmful consequences that follow. Your flawed foundation has consequences,
right,
and they are not really acceptable. That's my view.
What he has spelled out in his book, would it come under the category of what we normally recognize as paradharma in our discussions that we have here?
That's a very smart way of putting it. In fact, I was writing something about it this morning. That's exactly right. It is paradharma, but paradharma without a proper basis. It is like having a parliament that passes acts, but there is no constitution. England was the only country that used to do it. It was famously no constitution. But they had what I call, their constitution was their tradition. That is why in English law, tradition is sacred.
Precedence.
Precedence, as they call it in the legal field. That's right.
Here the Gurcharan Das uses, Bhagavan in Dharmavani uses the word Acharana Dharma, which has to be based on Atma Dharma.
So Acharana Dharma is Paradharma.
Paradharma.
See, here there is a very subtle point. In one of the slokas, he talks of Sadharma and Paradharma. And it is very confusing to people. In fact, I have got a question from a lady in Holland. It has been sitting with me for months. I had no time to read it, answer it. The Swadharma and Paradharma, that comes in fourth chapter, I don't remember, somewhere. What Krishna is telling Arjuna is, when he refers to Arjuna's Swadharma, the Swa refers to the body, because Arjuna is still very body conscious. That's why he's getting all the dose of Bhagavad Gita. You body conscious Arjuna, you follow the Dharma of your body with all the ego personality. So your job is to be a Kshatriya and not try to be a sannyasi. With respect to Arjuna, who is body conscious, other people are para. Para means other. With respect to you, a teacher is someone else. Sannyasi is someone else. You being a soldier must act like a soldier, not like a sannyasi. Swami has told us stories like that. On the other hand, when it comes to fundamentals, fundas, the I is the egoless self. Swa at that stem becomes Atman. Because it is the Atman which is shrouded by Maya and delusion that becomes the Jivatman. So Swadharma then becomes the Atma of the Dharma or the higher self. Then who is the other? When that Dharma has shrouds, it becomes a Jivatma which is diluted. Which thinks it is Arjuna, the body. So he says, at that level, you are following Paradharma, the Dharma of the body. You should really link that Paradharma to Atma Dharma. So he says, follow this, but have a basis. Plug it there and make sure there is alignment. So when we talk of Swadharma and quote this, then people get confused. The word swa has got two levels. Para has also got two senses, so you get many combinations and all. But as you say, what Gurucharan Das is only talking about paradharma of X, Y, and Z. Right. They all have paradharmas, but it must be linked to one source. That is what he is saying.
Because
he is not saying, I am saying.
Got it. And paradharma actually, it seems to have a very fluid basis. That is to say, you know, with circumstances it tends to change. Whereas Atma Dharma is something, you know, that stands a test of time.
See, paradharma is a manual regarding doing.
Right.
It has to be a function of space and time.
Yes.
There is no question about it. And Swami has given very simple examples. In fact, one of the examples he gives is, you are a judge of the High Court. So when you sit in court, you must wear legal robes, and you must conduct yourself in a manner that befits the bench. Okay. Once you come to your house, it's Sunday, holiday, you wear kutta pajama. You are playing with your grandchildren. Grandkids say, I want to ride on you. So you crawl on the floor with the kid sitting and say, hi, hi, and all that.
Yes.
So that's not the way a judge is supposed to behave. So, the circumstances ask you to play the role of a grandfather. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you may be invited to a Rotary Club meeting. You are not in the bench. You are addressing an audience. So you have to address the audience in a suitable manner that does not in any way compromise the judiciary. I mean, you should not make remarks against the judiciary or the legal system and things like that, because you are subservient. However, you can make comments that can make people think. Should it be like this? This is the dilemma that is faced when interpreting the law, and we are helpless because we have to uphold the constitution, and society is paying. Times change, technology change produces changes in lifestyle. So these are issues we have to rethink. That can be done. So he has to play a different role there. Everybody has to play different roles in life, because you can't be a kid all your life. Just because your mother carried you when you were 1 year old, you can't, as a 25-year-old, ask your mother, carry me on your back or something like that. It has to change. It has to be adaptive.
So, but one difficulty when you move from paradharma to swadharma. So in paradharma, you have the comfort of, you know, you can refer to a manual or refer to society. Whereas when it comes to swadharma, on what basis do I act? Like, how do I listen to the voice of the Atma, or how do I know I'm in touch with?
There are two questions here. How do I listen is a separate thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do I talk on the phone? It means first your phone must be in working order. Yes. If it's not working order, then you have to get that repaired.
Got it.
But then the question is, let us say the phone is working. So what do I say? I must have something to say. I have to consult.
Yes.
So what is the question I'm going to ask? That also is another point. Now, actually, that can become a very difficult question. But I can make it very simple for you and me. I am going to do something. I don't know whether it's right or wrong. I want an independent opinion.
Yes.
A spiritually discriminated opinion. It's not something what I call trivial. Should I wear the blue shirt or red shirt? I'm not asking a question like that. There's a course of action. It doesn't look okay to me. I want an opinion. Instead of racking our head, we can simply ask the following question. If I do this, will Swami be happy? To the extent we have understood Swami's teachings,
yes,
you will get the correct answer. It's very easy. It may be tough. You may want to do it, but Swami says, not. Then you just don't do it. Unfortunately, that blessing is not available to millions and millions.
Yes,
we don't realize one of the precious gifts we had is even being in his presence and listening. He might not have called us and given us Padnamaskar and all the things we envy each other for. But at least he has left so many things. For example, my dear students, how many people know that there's a book like that? If you go today in the ashram, my dear students, what does it remind you of? You just put it like that. It will become a tough quiz question. Hmm. Is that the way Swami calls students? What does it mean? They don't know it's the book, on every line of which is precious advice. He has codified it in 100,000 ways. So with all that, if I ask the question, will Swami be pleased? He has told me this will not please me, this will not please me. He doesn't put it that way, but it's implicit. So it is very easy to find the answer. But not for a man in the street.
Yes.
Because he's not been exposed to all these things.
But in the Dharma Vahini,
yes,
Swami is giving us a path, I would say, a clue, where Bhagavan is telling that if in your daily avocations, you translate the real values of eternal Dharma into love-filled acts, then your duty to the inner reality, the Atma Dharma, is also fulfilled. Always build your living on the Atmic plinth, then your progress is assured.
Oh, listen, nobody has time for all that. Instead, taking it as an emergency, I want to do this.
Yes.
Who has time to read Dharma Vahini? I want to do this. Should I do it or not? Simple. If I does it, will he like or will he not like?
Yes.
That's a simple thing. That what you are saying, people are conveniently not aware of.
Because for the man on the street, I think the thumb rule would just be, above all, do no harm. Like, which is...
That's what Bhagavan is saying. It should be a love-filled act.
See, above all, do no harm. Then there becomes there comes a lot of accountancy problem.
Yes.
They will say, this is bad now, but it will do larger good. Most of it is phony. Most of the wars... Yes, people will die, but it will do larger good.
Everything is justified in... can be justified.
No, but the point is, nobody asks, why don't we behave in such a manner that there is no war in the first place? Yes. Why should we start? That nobody wants to do. Because asking people not to fight means that they must exercise a lot of self-control, which they don't want to. They are under the thumb of ego. He says, what do you mean? That fellow is insulting you. Buddha said, ignore it. He throws insult. Unless you catch it, it doesn't become yours.
Yes.
That's not mine. I have nothing to do with it.
So, like, what about just wars, you know, where you find that there is... Let's talk about something current, say ISIS in Syria and Iraq.
See, that's current day politics. I don't want to go into that.
Right.
But I want to know, who decides about just war? Sorry, who decides about just war? I decide.
Right, sir.
How much of buddhi have I applied? And how much of discrimination have I applied? We don't know. We don't ask that question. There is a very famous incident that answers your question. During the American Civil War, which was fought for certain principles and also for certain other principles, one of which was whether the Union should be broken up or not. It was not really fought for slavery, but that was a background cause, and it showed up later. One pastor went to Abraham Lincoln and said, Mr. President, I am very sure we'll win this war. He said, Pastor, what makes you so sure? He said, Mr. President, don't you know God is on our side? And Abraham Lincoln said, I'm not so sure about that, but I am sure that we should try to be on God's side.
Yes.
So because the other fellow will also be praying to God.
Yes.
So I remember seeing in India-Pakistan matches back in the old days, 30 years ago, all the Muslims will be praying in Sharjah, there will be a match between India-Pakistan. Allah, give victory to us, and Indians will be trying to do something, home, or something. Yeah, God has no better business than one silly one-day match. So this business of just is coming out of your ego. In most of the wars, both sides will say we are fighting a just war. I'm not prepared to take all those evaluations. Why did the war start in the first place? Who was responsible?
Yeah.
Could it have been avoided? Those questions are seldom asked. Although history is full of examples, we continue to repeat the mistakes we made earlier. Because we are trapped in the same ego.
That brings us back to this difficulty in, like, how do I, you know, even arbitrate on such matters? Let us take, for example, the issue of, say, piracy, sir, music piracy that is there. One of the arguments that was very elegant argument that was brought forth was, when a person, you know, he illegally downloads a music file, that is not a sale that is anyway taking place. He is buying it at the price that he is willing to pay, at the price that the, say, Sony or any other company, at that price this person is not willing to buy that music. That is A. B is that, you know, because now he's been able to buy that music, he's able to appreciate that particular singer, which he perhaps otherwise would not have been able to, and therefore he may be inclined to actually buy his records later. This is just one of the arguments put forth.
Look, now, you are talking of one corner of a very complex system,
yes,
which is 90% illegal and 10% legal.
Right.
The whole idea of, you know, patent and all that,
yeah,
it looks all right. But on the other hand, I could have taken the view, I will not patent.
Right. Like,
if you go to Bose Institute in Calcutta, which I did only once, Sir J.C. Bose founded it along the lines of the Royal Institution, which was established by Faraday. There is a board. I saw it, I was very impressed. But that was way back in 1890s or so. It is right next to the Calcutta University. It says, any discovery made in this institute will belong to the people of the world, to humanity.
Right.
Wow.
That was his view. The day has come when university staff started patenting molecules, because it may be a good anti-cancer drug, you know, it may be. So they hide a lot of data. There is a journal called Acta Crystallographica. It's a very old journal. Crystallographic results are published in that. In the old days, when you studied a molecular structure, unravel the structure, mostly using X-ray diffraction, you have to publish in the paper, the coordinates of every atom. Without that, the paper will not be accepted. The reason is, if somebody else repeats that experiment, his coordinates must match. If they don't match, then it means one of the persons has done wrong. Yeah. And the third person will find out what is the correct thing. Sometimes it may happen the other fellow's data will be more accurate, which is fine. I mean, that's the way it goes. So there is an openness and transparency. That is what an academic institute should sponsor and foster.
Absolutely.
Now, if the academic institution becomes a player in the market, it is no longer Saraswati, it is Lakshmi, as Swami used to say.
Sir,
There is this question of what you call copyright, etc., etc., is a part of the transactional process which we in society have evolved. And at the end of the day, you are nitpicking on whether this is right or that is wrong. That is a matter of detail. You can argue, a smart lawyer side will argue this way, smart lawyer will argue on the other side. But I ask, go back to the fundamental, who owns whose for what?
Actually,
something like that.
The polio vaccine, the inventor of the polio vaccine, Salk, he did not claim any patent rights on that. He didn't earn any.
I'm well aware of that. In fact, that man was himself affected by polio. That's why he went into this. Salk. And that was the case with many other things.
Yes. And
Alexander Fleming did not patent penicillin.
No, the fact that we're able to eradicate polio vaccine in many third world countries.
People are not prepared to think like that.
Right, sir.
Today, at the same time, all the people say internet, everything is free. So it's going on. But luckily, of all places in the internet, they have got copy left instead of copyright.
Yes. Yes.
And there are all sorts of things that the corporates have come together now to crush, because for them, making money and making as much profit as possible has become the code of life. The winner takes all. They have introduced Darwinism into human life. The human life has been degraded to that of an animal. At least animals follow some reason. Here, there is no reason.
One is to say no reason. Animals have reason and season.
Yeah,
so in that sense, dharma is actually a path of inquiry. Like at any time, if you can delineate for yourself who you are being in that particular situation, that
I would say dharma is not, in my opinion, path of inquiry. Inquiry leads you to dharma. Otherwise, it sits by itself. If you want to go to some place, you can do it in two ways. If you don't know, you just try to find out where it is. Or else you ask, this is the address, how do I go? We do this often. We go in auto rickshaw, that fellow stops somewhere, where is this, is this? It happens in all countries. So, the path of inquiry is essential. You have to be a jignasu. Then only you will know how to go in this. If I am content with being arti and artate, then the question of jignasu doesn't arise.
Yes.
So in that sense, you are right. I must have the thirst to know. Moment you have the thirst, everything will become clear and you will know how to steer.
Because dharma, therefore, the question of dharma would be one of the triggers. Like, because as you are saying, like paradharma is dictated by the circumstance you find yourself in. And
I would also put it that way.
Sir.
If you are in this, do this. If then, paradharma is also a book.
Right.
See,
absolutely.
When in Rome, do as Romans do. That's a rule. So that sort of things Manu and others had written.
Yes.
And Artha, Kautilya wrote, there are four aspects of what you call law and justice. As Amartya Sen says, one is purely metaphysical and the other is something mystical or something. I forget. The last two relate to the earth. That is, how do you govern? How do you levy taxes? How do you protect the country? How do you have spies? All these things are written down. And in the Ramayana, I was very struck when I was doing the Ramayana book that when Bharata comes to Chitrakuta, then what happens is, before Bharata could open his mouth, Rama starts giving him advice about how to govern.
Yes.
And I was very taken aback. I know Bhishma has given this and all that to Yudhishthira. But I didn't know that Rama did the same thing. Exactly the same thing. I hope the country is being governed well. This is what we must do. A, B, C, D. That fellow is stunned. He doesn't even have time to say, Father is no more. Come back. So this business of governance is very important in daily life. It is in the corporate sector, it becomes management. Actually, it's not corporate sector. Any institution, a hospital has to be managed, a school has to be managed, even a jail has to be managed, a kitchen has to be managed. There is nothing which doesn't have to be managed, including ourselves and our character.
And Gurcharan Das uses that word real politic, and that is where he says that, you know, there is an ideal situation, and when it comes to actually brass tacks and pragmatism, there are certain quote-unquote exigencies and...
No, that is inescapable. You see, in real life, you are faced with it. That's why I say, a prophet usually ends up getting stoned. A leader is hailed for the compromises he makes. When you stand for election, there are many parties, nobody has a majority. You have to make compromises. Yeah. The only thing is you try to make compromises that are ethical. But when people abandon ethics, it becomes horse trading. Not many people know that Belgium is a country which runs without government for 8 to 10 months after election.
Mm-hmm.
There are at loggerheads, but there is a place called Brussels where the European Union meets and it has all its offices. So everybody gets his business done in the sense, you know, the restaurants thrive, theaters thrive, travel agents thrive. They couldn't care less whether there's a government or not. So you see there the proper problems with compromise.
Yes.
Gandhiji was very difficult. He wouldn't compromise on fundamentals. And as time went on, when moral values declined, the question of compromise has become very serious.
Yes.
The first and second generation, at least, we had politicians who had morals, scruples. So it was only a question of principles. Not on what you call ethical, there was no compromise on ethical grounds. It was only political grounds. But when you have to make deals with the devil, actually it becomes deals between devils.
I think there are a lot more questions that come when we come down to the brass tacks. And how to actually...
That is why the price of brass is high. So much of brass tech is being sold.
But I think time is running out. and Raghu is waiting to for our next segment. So probably we will have to postpone this discussion. And I know this whole thing of discussing Dharma, we really didn't come so much into Duryodhana's character today. I think
you know, somebody shouldn't ask us, what the hell do you mean by talking about Dharma? Do you practice Dharma yourself? That is the day when the show comes to an abrupt end. If people don't like us, they will send that question. So you tell whoever is managing our webmaster, who is the webmaster? Is a question I got, stop that question. So we will say we never heard it. We are plotting on open air.
I mean, I think everybody is on that path. just like you can never attain God. God is Dharma. You can never attain God. You can never say that I am.
Hey, don't go back. You're talking again. No. Please don't. God can be obtained. People have got moksha.
It's not an easy... Yes.
Have you switched sides? Okay. Sorry.
Anyway, so we'll continue this discussion. Thank you so much, sir, for this taking a break from your musings and allowing us this Q&A session. And I hope that we will have more Q&A sessions in this series. And thank you, Harishankar, for coming over and asking those questions. And through you, I think a lot of people's questions also would have got answered.
It's a good opportunity to sit across a table with somebody like Dr. Venkatraman. A very tall intellectual and can throw a lot of light on subjects like this. So,
yes,
it's a good opportunity for me.
Yes. So dear listeners, I will hand over the mic now to Sunil to take us to conclude this program, and then we'll move on to Raghu for our segment, Service Love in Action.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, that brings to an end the fourth Q&A session on Professor Venkatraman's earlier talks in his new series related to Dharma. We hope you like the session. And next week, we'll be continuing the present series. Please do not forget to tune in then. And we shall alert you in advance with web and radio announcements about what's coming up for next week. So, watch this space. We thank you for listening and request you to inform those of whom you know and are not aware of this series also to join us in the future. As usual, the broadcast of this program may be accessed via our website, www.radiosci.org. Dear listener, coming up next on Thursday Live is the segment Service Love in Action. Thank you and Sai Ram.
Govinda Krishna Vithala Venu Gopala Krishna Vithala
Govinda Krishna Vithala Venu Gopala Krishna Vithala
Govinda Krishna Vithala Venu Gopala Krishna Vithala
Pandharinath Vithala.
ಶೈಲಗಿರೀಶ್ವರ ಉಮಾ ಮಹೇಶ್ವರ ಶೈಲಗಿರೀಶ್ವರ ಉಮಾ ಮಹೇಶ್ವರ ಕಾಶೀ ವಿಶ್ವೇಶ್ವರ ಸದಾ ಶಿವ ಕಾಶೀ ವಿಶ್ವೇಶ್ವರ ಸದಾ ಶಿವ ಕಾಶೀ ವಿಶ್ವೇಶ್ವರ ಸದಾ ಶಿವ ಸದಾ ಶಿವ ಸದಾ ಶಿವ ಸದಾ ಶಿವ ಶಂಭೋ ಸದಾ ಶಿವ ಸದಾ ಶಿವ ಶಂಭೋ ಸದಾ ಶಿವ ಶೈಲಗಿರೀಶ್ವರ ಉಮಾ ಮಹೇಶ್ವರ